Roadman, welcome back. Today, I'm thrilled to be joined by Dr. Howard Lukes. If you're a regular to the show, you'll realize that I've been searching for the answers around health, happiness, and longevity for quite a while. Almost 1,000 episodes now. Dr. Lukes is one of the brightest voices I found in this entire journey. He's a renowned orthopedic surgeon and authority in the sports medicine domain. He's also a trailblazer for using digital platforms and social media to demystify complex topics, complex medical topics, and engage with broader audiences about the nuances of healthcare decision making. In our conversation today, we get really tactical. We talk about what you should and what you shouldn't be doing if you want to live a long, healthy, happy life. You may have been waiting 1,000 episodes for this conversation. To support this podcast, please check out our sponsors in the description below. And now, my friends, it's Dr. Howard Lukes. Dr. Howard, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Anthony. It's good to be here.
I want to have this conversation around the big levers in health. I listen to so many podcasts lately, and it just feels like everyone's majoring in the minor stuff. Like they're having full podcasts about, I don't know, infrared saunas or cold plunges. I think that stuff has a place. But the byproduct of this has been friends of mine who live massively unhealthy lives in almost every aspect, where they drink too much, they eat to excess, they don't move enough. And then they're talking to me about how they got a new cold plunge in the house. And I'm like,
for $4,000.
Yeah. I'm like, you know what? There was easier things you could have done, but they're well intentioned. But I want to focus this conversation around the big levers we can pull on health.
Sure. You know, did you read my book? I'm just curious. I don't remember.
I've read a summary of your book.
You didn't. Okay, fine. So this is why I wanted to write a book, because we overly complicate things. While there are too many people who don't train, who don't ride, who don't run, there are many people who train too much. They're overtrained, much like you spoke about on Twitter the other day. But there's nothing like that as severe as it is in the longevity or lifespan space. And I similarly have friends who are spending a fortune on supplements, on saunas, on cold plunges, on special mattresses, yet they don't move enough. They walk under 6,000 steps a day. They don't work out. They don't work on strength, power, fitness, balance. They don't control their diet. They clearly drink too much. And that's just not the right strategy. As you alluded to, there may be a role for sauna, right? It seems that the data supports that. There's not much of a role for cold plunges. There's very little role for most supplements. You know, I'm asked all the time. And all I really take is creatine and vitamin D in the winter and some protein. That's it. That's all I have room for. So unless you're optimizing your sleep schedule, your diet, your exercise, and various strength training protocols, then you're not ready for the 0.001% increase that you're going to get from optimizing your supplements and your sauna and cold plunge schedule.
Have you ever read Money, Master the Game? Tony Robbins is the author.
I have not.
So it's an interesting premise. Tony Robbins obviously has been the, you know, motivational public speaker for, you know, 3-4 decades. But because of that, he has almost unprecedented access to some of the wealthiest people in the world. So he asked some of the best investors of all time, like your Warren Buffett's, Ray Dalio's. He asked them one question. He said, if you couldn't pass on any of your financial legacy to your children, you could only give them a piece of advice to endure them for their lifetime. What advice would you give? That's such an interesting question. And I wonder if I was to push that same question to you, if you couldn't give a blueprint, you could only give one single piece of advice. Like, what's the main thing? Because we've established the main thing isn't the saunas, the cold plunges. Is there a singular focus that you think, okay, if you get that right, that's the domino that could knock over the other dominoes?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I just answered a question about that on Twitter. It's not even something that I taught them. It's something that they learned from observing me, because I was, for the longest time, just a runner. But I ran when it was raining, snowing, icy, cold, hot. It just didn't matter. They saw their dad get in his car, drive to the trails, come back home, change his clothes, get ready for the day. They saw the smile on my face. And they see my fitness level, especially now compared to their friends' parents, who, you know, we're all getting up into our low 60s now. And I never had to tell my kids to exercise. They just did it. As you learn as a parent, kids don't often do what you tell them to do, but they will emulate behavior very well.
Yeah.
So this was a nonverbal lesson that I gave my kids that I think it's going to have important ramifications for their entire life.
What's the challenge like in your practice? Because the idea of sauna, cold plunge, this stuff, I think it's attractive because it's easy. You can say, well, it almost comes into the phrase of just do this, just take this medication, just do this one thing, when that reductionist argument doesn't really work around health. There's no just do this. There's actually, you know, quite a lot goes into it. It's a 24/7 process, 365. How was that as a kind of thought experiment changing hearts and minds with your patients and say, actually, there's no just do this?
Yeah, it's a conversation that we have 10 times a day. I should just play a CD on an internet.
You can play this podcast.
But you know, because we overly complicate things, our approach, one, it needs to be simplified, and two, it needs to be reproducible, and three, you can't pick and choose the aspects of an approach to longevity that you like the best. Because if you're not sleeping well, but you're eating well, and you're drinking too much, and you do exercise, you're not going to have the gains that you should have if you control all the available variables. And if you're not paying attention to your sleep, your strength, your running, your aerobic challenges, et cetera, then it doesn't really matter how long you spend in a cold plunge or how much you spend on supplements. So I try to walk people back from that. And as I did in my book, I spend a bit of time explaining where metabolic disease comes from, right? What is fatty liver, type 2 diabetes, insulin resistance, et cetera, and how sleeping better influences and improves our insulin resistance, how eating better improves our insulin resistance, how walking more improves it. And now they start to draw all the associations and they start to understand how everything is so complex and interrelated, and why the strategies involve doing all of the above as opposed to just one of the above and trying to supplement with something else.
It almost feels like we've taken an evolutionary misstep, that we're living in a body that's not designed for the new world we've created. Like, we need to be moving a lot from all the research that I've seen. Yet we fashion this society where we get into a metal box and we drive to work and then we sit in a metal box and then we get into another metal box and we drive home.
You're absolutely correct. We're living with a bunch of evolutionary mismatches right now, right? Let's face it, we were engineered to move. Plain and simple. That's what our body can do. It can move long distances relatively slowly. But, you know, we had to gather food. We had to forage. We needed water to wash ourselves or to drink. And we just don't do that anymore. And we are also engineered in times where of food scarcity. So we're engineered to save energy. And how do we do that? Because we're extremely good at turning food into fat. I'm not going to get into, you know, diets, but that's how our bodies survived famines. Because we had feasts and famines depending where we were in the world. And so we have genetic susceptibilities that are starting to show themselves because we don't have patterns of feast and famine anymore. So we are living with a lot of these evolutionary mismatches that our body just has not had the time to contend with. And we have big food, which is over-engineering our food processes, making the food too alluring, and there's not enough satiety. And now we have pharma trying to break the hold that big food has on us. So, and they've been successful with the GLP-1s, and soon big food is going to figure it out, and we're going to just be in this race to the bottom.
How bad's the news, though, for somebody who's living a standard American diet, who's working 9 to 5s or commuting by car, less than 500 steps a day, not doing any strength training? How bad's the outlook for them?
Well, look, I mean, the outlook for the average age of an American, for the most part, is going down. It's not as bad as in women. And it's one of the few countries where that's true. And while, you know, people who are 60 years old now can expect to live into their 80s, our ability to compress morbidity now is starting to be limited. And we are having a higher prevalence of diabetes and other issues. So that's going to impact our ability to live and thrive longer. I think that's the critical part, really. It's, yes, we're living, but are we thriving, right? If you're spending all day going from doctor to doctor to doctor to pick up your 12 medicines, and you're having difficulty going from your car up the stairs into your house, you're not really thriving. And that's not how I want to pass through my last few decades.
Hey, Robman, excuse the short interruption. I love riding the bike, but on account of being so busy with the podcast at the moment, I'm now what's called a time-crunched rider. I never thought I'd see the day. But I have a tool. I'm using Wattbike to keep myself sharp and on point with specific sessions to maximize that available training time. I have a Wattbike Atom right here in the recording studio beside me. And when I have an hour in between interviews, I jump on. It's removing all the friction points for me. There's no more 10-minute setup, unfolding legs, banging my knees off stuff, getting my hands dirty, the usual connection issues. It just works every single time. The Atom's perfect for virtual racing as well because it has crisp gear changes, it has 1% accuracy, and it has max gradient capability of up to 25%. If you're looking for an indoor trainer, I honestly couldn't recommend this any higher. I've been using a Wattbike since 2013. Honestly, it's the last indoor trainer that you're ever going to need. If you head on over to wattbike.com now and use code ROADMAN10, that's ROADMENTEN, and that's going to get you 10% off your Wattbike. There seems to be a movement of very prominent doctors, physiologists, and scientists who are trying to lay out this blueprint for longevity. And it's great to see because my background, I come from law. And a frustration I had for a long time is the very credible academics. They're so worried about conflicting academic thought. They don't want to put themselves out into the public sphere for fear of academic criticism. So what happens is you have pseudo-academics who step in and they shout louder than everyone else, and they don't always have the best information. But now there is amazing people like you, Alan Cousins, that are coming forward, and they're talking quite a lot about, okay, it's actually not that complicated. We need to move every day a lot. And I think Alan Cousins even has this idea of a big metabolic day a week, which is just an entire day of moving. And that's bizarre for most people to hear that you need to move that much.
Yeah, well, you know, it's funny. I started to post on Instagram a few months ago at the suggestion of some friends after my success on X or Twitter. And what I quickly found out is that, you know, simple, actionable information just doesn't scale on Instagram, right? The wilder and crazier it is, the more followers that you're going to have and the more engagement. It's just insane. So I can put up, you know, a graph of a 3-hour zone 2 cycle. It just has a flat line in zone 2. Nothing, right? cricket. But if I show myself benching 225 and then jumping up and down and turning sideways six times, I'm going to get, you know, a lot of applause. It's insane. However, what's clear for me is, look, I'm at the twilight of my career, right? So I don't care if people come at me and say, no, you're wrong, it's this, or no, you're wrong, it's this. Fine. You know, I don't have to protect my academic stature. I feel just fine with where I am in life. And I'm just sharing this because I want to help people. That's my only motive right now. So, you know, I have nothing else to sell you.
Intention is powerful as well.
Totally. And look, and I walk the walk. You know, I'm right there alongside with you. I don't love every run or ride every day. I don't like to sit on a trainer for 3 hours. As I mentioned online the other day, it's just as much to train my brain for adversity as it is to train my mitochondria, because it's not easy to sit your ass on a saddle for 3 hours and not move horizontally. But look, you know, that's why Alan and I and others are out there. We're sharing very simple information. This isn't rocket science. You can live a longer life if you concentrate on these few things. And if you don't, you're going to bear the consequences of it. And that's fine.
Yeah. I think that's a really interesting point, because there's a lot more consensus than there is conflict. But the conflict's often blown up to make it seem like, oh, diet's just so confusing. I don't understand. There's so many different tribes in diet. But actually, the consensus is quite strong. We can't be eating processed food. We can't be in a calorie surplus every day of the week. You know, we can't be eating foods that are just laden with toxins. You know, it needs to be a relatively clean diet, regardless of what tribal food philosophy you fall into, whether it's paleo, carnivore, vegan. Everyone roughly subscribes to that same idea. Now, there are junk food vegans and stuff out there, but broadly, everyone subscribes to those principles.
No, you're absolutely correct. And I tried to stay, in the second version of my book, which I'm writing now, I really stayed away from diet and a few basic strategies. And that was it. You know, avoid ultra-processed foods. Avoid the nonsense that's online, avoid rabbit holes. And yes, it's okay to eat blueberries. you know, I mean, when I come home from a long, long run or a 3 hour ride, you know, I have to take in a lot of calories, and I don't care whether they're carbs. I don't care if it's oatmeal. I happen to love oatmeal. I put a bowl of oatmeal up on Twitter once just to excite the crowd because I knew the effect it would have. And you had to read these replies. It's just astonishing.
So what does a week of movement look like for you at the moment?
Ah, good question. So, I'm changing seasons now. So I start to dial back on my cycling, which is typically 4 days a week. I do about a half hour of yoga in the morning, almost as soon as I wake up. I run 3 days a week, and I'm in the gym 3 days a week, and I do Krav Maga. So that's 1 or 2 days a week.
It's pretty full on.
It is full on. It's very active life.
And I've noticed when I've gone from being basically an active couch potato, where I was riding the bike maybe 15 to 20 hours a week. But when I wasn't on the bike, I was totally stationary. And I was looking back at historic step counts. Some days I'm getting less than 500 steps in. I'm riding my bike. I'm walking up the stairs to my apartment. And I'm basically not coming out again. I'm working on the laptop, recording podcasts, researching, stationary. And the big move I've made now in the past few months is this move away from a cycling-centric lifestyle and try to integrate more steps into my day. But initially, it's a challenge. And you kind of think to yourself, well, how am I going to get 15, 20,000 steps in a day? And it forces creativity. You start saying, okay, well, where's the calls I can take when I'm on the go? Instead of driving to the grocery store, can I carry a backpack to the grocery store? Yep. Can I take that meeting walking? Can I, you know, do preparation for the podcast. Like I listened to two or three previous podcast appearances from yourself, just out walking the dogs around in circles with a notebook in my hand, just taking notes like an eccentric poet in the park.
That's my same strategy here. You know, there are days in Maybe I only did a 3 or 4 mile run in the morning and then I went to work. But I'll get home, I'll put the dog's leashes on and I'm going out for a walk with them. I mean, they need it too. And I just need to clear my head and I need my steps. I have, you know, 45 minutes or an hour for quote unquote lunch scheduled in to my days now in the office. And very often I'll have the final 30 minutes, you know, I leave the office for a walk. Rain, sun, cold, shine. I just want to get those steps in. It's just something that I realized that's necessary. It's, look, you know, I don't know about you, but the majority of my workouts aren't necessarily fun. The majority of the things that I do aren't for enjoyment. I just realized that I have to do this. And no, I'm not addicted to exercise. No, these aren't 6 hour long sessions for me. I just realized what I need to do. I brought 3 kids into this world and we all know how messed up it is. And I think they're going to benefit from my presence if I'm around a lot longer. So, and I'm sort of having fun. So, you know, yeah.
What's the role of mobility and flexibility and balance? Because they're words that are a little bit foreign to me and they're areas I've definitely... I see a lot of elite athletes neglecting, and then by proxy, your general public. If elite athletes are neglecting it, general Joe public is not even considering it.
Yeah, that's very true. So my workouts, look, you know, you're 40, as I think I saw on Twitter, turning 40. Yeah. And what you're going to start to notice is, you know, you stumble on things a little more often, or you get up from a chair and you wobble a little before you're able to, you know, to move forward. These are normal age-appropriate changes that start to take place. You've lost quickness. You've lost power. Maybe not in cycling-specific moves, but with regards to other things, sure. And the changes are fairly dramatic. You know, we lose 1% of our muscle mass per year early on in our 30s, but that just starts to rapidly accelerate. And by the time you get to 60 for many, they've lost a considerable amount of muscle mass. Worse, if you throw in a hospitalization, you know, a week in the hospital with very little activity, and you can lose another 10% of your muscle mass.
Oh, that's there. Massive.
Not only are you losing, it's massive. Not only are you losing strength, with that loss of muscle mass, but you're losing the metabolic benefits of that muscle mass, right? Our muscles are our largest glucose sink in our body. So when we take in a glucose load, the muscles are sucking that glucose up and turning it and storing it as glycogen for our energy needs. But if you have less muscle, you have a smaller glucose sink. If those muscles are used to be metabolically active and they're healthy, you're going to be turning over that glucose at a massive scale. But if you've lost muscle, you're not. Now, it's important to realize that falls are an extraordinarily common root cause of death. Why? Because we fall. If we break our hip, upwards of 50% of people who break their hip are dead within a year.
I see this stat. Can you unpack that for me a little bit? Because it seems massive.
Well, I will. So falls are a common root cause of death. You didn't die from the fall per se, but it precipitated the entire process that's going to follow in a sadly predictable manner. So you fall, you're injured, you can't move. Let's say you're not in the hospital or you are for a few days, or perhaps you're in bed, perhaps you broke something and you're not moving for 6 weeks. You lost a tremendous amount of muscle mass. And not only that, the metabolic benefits of it. now you, the cast comes off, you're like, okay, let's do a little physical therapy. So you get moving and you're able to walk, and the physical therapist says, okay, you're done. But you haven't done anything to recover the level of fitness that you lost. So now your baseline level of fitness is much lower. Now you go on, you trip over something else a few months later. Now, and not only that, but it was easier to trip because you didn't have the quickness to get that leg in front of you or the strength to stop yourself from falling forward. Now you have another injury. Now you're in bed for another week or two. Maybe you need an operation. You lost another 10% of your muscle mass. You get back up, you go to physical therapy for a few weeks, and your baseline is lower. And then eventually now you're going to spend more time, sitting on a couch. Your overall health is going to diminish. You're going to recognize some cognitive decline, poor cardiac function, and it ends in the demise of that individual far sooner than it would have if they didn't have that initial fall. So I say this because my workout have changed a lot. When I was young, it was mostly upper extremities, benching, curls, press, etc.
The beach
now
body.
It's not. Correct. Now it's not. Now it's 60% legs, quote unquote core, whatever you want to think that means. And it's a ton of power and quickness. So a lot of medicine balls, throwing it up, throwing it sideways, throwing it backwards, lifting heavy stones in the backyard, all single leg moves, jump squats, a lot of lateral movement. I'm still doing sprints. I ran a 177 10-yard dash the other day, which is
pretty fast. It's pretty fast.
For a 61-year-old, right?
It's pretty fast for a 40-year-old.
Right. Thank you very much. I appreciate that. So, the only way I've gotten there is by maintaining it. Once you've lost it, you can get some back, but a lot of the muscle fibers that you lose due to sarcopenia, which is the genetic base loss of muscle mass, it's a lot more complicated than just muscle atrophy, right? You've lost muscle cells. You've lost the satellite cells, which are the progenitor cells that lead to new muscle cells. So exercise can stimulate hypertrophy of the muscle that you have, so you can make up a lot of strength deficits. But you want to really prepare for aging by remaining strong, remaining quick, by having power. The difference between power and strength is there is a time component. So power is the ability to move weight quickly. So rapid squats, rapid leg extensions, rapid push-ups, etc. And then there's balance. So I do a ton of Bulgarian split squats. I do a lot of work with a cable machine on a single leg squat. And I might be falling all over the place, but it's okay because gradually I'm getting better and better and better. And look, I'm going to lose balance and quickness as I age. That's just going to happen. But I can slow the decline dramatically. And if I stumble on something, I know my leg is going to move forward fast and my thigh is going to just stop me straight from falling.
It's really interesting you talk about the massive amount of muscle we lose when we stop. I was talking to an elderly cyclist that I ride with on the weekends, and he is 84 years old this year, and he can ride with the first cat rider still. Like, you look at him from the waist down, he looks like he's 16. Like, phenomenal athlete still. He was at a super high level in his 20s and 30s and into his 40s. And I was chatting to him and I was like, what's the secret to this? And he said, never take a break. He's like, don't do the comeback. He said, he's seen so many athletes that are like, oh, I'll take a year off and then I'll come back next year. He's like, you never come back. He's like, you start this stair step down and then you last 3 years on the comeback, you take a year off, then you say, oh, I'll come back next year, and you stair step down. He said his level has dipped, but very slowly every year since he's been 30, 35, and his level's still pretty high. Rob Mann, I know how serious you take your goal setting, whether they're fitness or life-related goals. If you're looking for a powerful ally to support you on this journey, look no further than Huel. Huel has become my secret weapon for when I don't have time to prepare a balanced meal. It ensures I get the nutrition I need without sacrificing time or taste. Plus, it stops me from reaching for that takeaway menu. I always throw a bottle into my backpack when I'm heading into the city to work, and it stops me eating junk convenience foods, snacking on croissants and bars of chocolate, because I know they don't support my training goals. It's a handy, nutritious meal on the go, and it's got over 22 grams of protein. Huel is perfect for athletes that don't have time to cook or prepare food before a training session. It's convenient, nutritious fuel at your fingertips, ensuring you hit your daily fueling needs for that session. Huel Ready to Drink has 26 essential vitamins and minerals in every single bottle. You're getting a whopping 175 health benefits. Plus, it's made from natural ingredients like tapioca, sunflower seed, coconut, and more. The best part? It's the flavors. There's 8 crazy beautiful flavors. Iced coffee is what's in my backpack right at the moment. You can get Huel directly to your home. All you got to do is head on over to the Huel website, huel.com/roadman.
We can maintain an extraordinary level of fitness. My DEXA scans are solid. I have a VO2 max of 51. It's down from 56 or 55 a few years back, 5-6 years ago. But look, these are inevitable changes, but it's still higher than a very fit 30-year-old in the U.S. So you can maintain a lot of these parameters with effort. That's how I've designed my workouts now. The biggest change that I've made is how I pursue these strength training days. It's not just benching, squatting, and deadlifting.
You mentioned VO2 max. How does VO2 max serve as an indicator of health as we age? Because I suppose a lot of us are familiar with it as a term for peer comparison among elite athletes.
Yeah, sure. So obviously it has a lot to say about your overall fitness level, but what people fail to understand is everything that's involved in producing your VO2 max. So your VO2 max is a measure of how much oxygen your body is capable of delivering and burning. So in order to deliver the oxygen, you need well-functioning lungs, right? You can't have asthma, COPD, or various lung diseases. Then you need to bring that oxygen molecule across into the capillaries deep in the lung to get it to enter the bloodstream. So if you did smoke, if you have inflammatory conditions, and the air sacs in the lung are thicker or the capillaries are thicker and sluggish, that oxygen is not going to diffuse into the blood well. Now your heart needs to pump that blood. Your muscles can call for as much oxygen as they want, but if you can't increase your stroke volume and your heart rate, then you do not have the capacity to pump that blood to the muscles as fast as it needs to get there. Once the blood arrives, assuming you have no atherosclerosis and other blockages, which will limit the delivery, now you have to have enough capillaries within your muscle beds. You have to have a lot of muscle tissue. And the only way to develop capillaries is by using those muscles. This is one of the strong reasons why zone 1 and zone 2 training is super important, because it helps increase the capillarization or the growth of blood vessels within a muscle bed. So now you have to deliver that oxygen to your muscle cells, and they need to use it efficiently. So it needs to get into the cell. It needs to find functional mitochondria, right? If we're not healthy, well, and metabolically fit, and our mitochondria not functioning well, then we're not going to be able to use the oxygen as efficiently as we should. So this is why VO2 max is such a great measure of our overall cardiometabolic fitness, because there's so many systems that come into play and there's so many maladies that if we have them are going to dramatically affect what our maximal VO2 max can be. And there are the average 60, I mean, I'm 61. The average 61-year-old male in the United States has a VO2 max of somewhere between 30 and 32, which is just extraordinary because, you know, you need a VO2 max of 25 to 28 to be able to climb a set of stairs without getting short of breath. So they're not very high above that threshold.
Average is a bad place to be these days. Listening to you, I'm wondering, do we almost, we have this idea, retirement is such a bad idea on so many levels. We won't get into that one today, but the idea of retiring and winding down as we age, if we want to hold on to VO2 max with expected muscle decline and deterioration in age, it seems like we're going to have to ramp up training, not ramp down training as we age. So how do you think about that ramping training up and managing recovery, which becomes more difficult at age?
Yeah, all right. So I'm sorry about my little dogs here.
I have two here as well, so I'm surprised you haven't heard them yet.
So, yeah, ramping up. You know, it's funny. I've tracked my HRV with HRV for training, Marco's app.
Just downloaded it last week.
For a long, long time. And when I was young and pig-headed, I sort of ignored it. But it has accurately predicted every time that Howard broke, whether it was a physical break, you know, a mental break, a physiological break. I knew that when I hit a certain level of fitness or when I hit a certain level of training or load on his platform, that if I didn't approach it really carefully, I was in for a month of badness. Whether something started hurting or it just didn't have any oomph in me, right? I wouldn't call it overtraining. I guess it is but it's clear that I was doing too much. So I respect that threshold now very well. I happen to have just pierced through it very recently. And to be honest, I'm very nervous about it because I don't like the month after this. But I'm just not going to ramp things up further. So what I tend to do is I'm much more efficient about my training. So, you know, I'm not going to do as long of a long ride or a long run so I can do some sprint work. So I'm going to keep my load sort of constant or just slightly higher. I'm going to be far more efficient with how I approach my load in the gym. So I might concentrate more on my balance or power and, and quickness, as opposed to strength of pulling a sled, as long as I like to. So I don't necessarily ramp what I do, but I'm much more efficient at it. And I'm very careful with load management because most injuries that I see in the office are training errors, right? For people who don't monitor load well. And since we just discussed a lot of the downsides associated with not moving and not doing things, that is something that I need to avoid more than anything else.
Well, I had Dr. David Lippman on the podcast, and he had a lovely expression where he was talking about the importance of consistency as well. And he said our long-term outcomes are much less defined by our ceiling than they are by our floor.
Yeah.
And I thought it's such a nice way to think about it. But with that being such an important theme as we age to maintain all the way through, how do you approach consistency? Because we see so many people that they'll listen to this podcast or someone will share another podcast with them and they're like, okay, I'm going to go on a health kick. I'm going to get motivated. And this seems to last 2, 3 weeks, 4 weeks, and it doesn't become sustainable habit change. How do you approach making those patients that come into your clinic that haven't lived the active life that you've always had. How do you approach that habit change with them? Rob, man, I've got something exciting to share with you. It's been making a huge difference in my performance of late, especially when it comes to my sleep. Allow me to introduce you to Pillar. We're probably all familiar with the importance of electrolytes and carbohydrates in our race preparation. Pillar is taking a slightly different route. It's focusing on something called micronutrition, ensuring you're ready to perform even before you ever hit the start line. It's all about promoting a good night's sleep, facilitating effective recovery, and replenishing those crucial micronutrients so you can perform your best. Over the past month, I've been running a little experiment. I've been incorporating Pillar's triple magnesium supplement into my routine. I take it 30 minutes before bed every night, and I've seen a remarkable improvement in my sleep quality and my HRV. I'm tracking this every single night using my Whoop, and the results are there in black and white. I wake up feeling refreshed, having had a deep restorative sleep, and I'm ready to take on work, take on training, or whatever life throws at me the next day. But I want you to do something. Don't take my word for this. Let the data from your fitness tracker tell you the story. If you're ready to elevate your performance and elevate your sleep quality like me, why not give Pillar a try? Head on over to pillarperformance.shop and use the code ROADMAN on your local website to get 15% off your first order. If you're listening in the US, you can head on over to thefeed.com/pillar and use the code ROADMAN for the same 15% off your first order.
It's really difficult. First of all, it's great if that spark shows up, especially if it shows up prior to a giant life event like your first heart attack. And as I alluded to, load management is just critical. Our bodies can handle an enormous amount of load as long as we bring it through those thresholds slowly, and we apply those loads slowly and actively over time. The problem arises when people first get the bug and they think that it has to hurt, and we have to sweat.
No pain, no gain.
Right. I have to do four sets to failure. Or worse, you have a 50-year-old who, when he was 25, benched 2.25. So, of course, his goal is 2.25 on his third gym session. And so, yeah, you know, it's a tough conversation because you don't want to shut them down, yet you don't want them to keep hurting themselves. So it's a challenging topic. It really is. Much like your cycling friend said, coming back from an injury, as I'm sure you know, can just be a nightmare, even if it hasn't been a year. It's never a linear process. We tend to ramp back too quickly and we injure ourselves again and we're back down. We're trying to get up, back down, trying to get back up. So it's a long process. So that's the information that I try to bring to the office to these people who are just starting out and things are starting to hurt a little too much now. First is the message that not all pain implies harm. However, you'd like to avoid this so it doesn't become an issue. And two, I'd like you to continue to be able to work out because of all the benefits. So I don't want you throw yourself against the wall with every workout, every run, every bike ride, each and every time. So I spend a lot of time on load management. I spend a lot of time with how to introduce intensity. I make it very clear, I am not against intensity. It's just we don't need a lot of it, plain and simple. So, yeah, it's a challenging topic. It's a challenging discussion. But once they've been injured, if they still want to go, then it's an easier conversation to be had than if I'm having the talk, you know, with someone who is telling me that they want to start exercising tonight. You know, inevitably they're going to hit that wall and push too hard.
I've always found with various coaches I've had through the years, if you think about training, then we have duration, frequency and intensity. Duration and frequency are surprisingly easy to get right and ramp once you keep intensity under control. Like, it doesn't require that much motivation. And I've often known it's time to change coach or something is not working for me when I find myself looking at my session that evening and I'm like, right, time for two shots of espresso here and throw on 15 minutes of David Goggins to get motivated for this session. There's just too much intensity in it for me. It needs too much willpower to get there. But when you have a session that you're like, oh, that actually looks quite pleasurable. I can flick on a YouTube video, a podcast, Netflix, jump on the Watt bike. It's not that hard to motivate yourself. And anecdotally, the friends I've seen that are getting back into training, they yank on that intensity lever way too hard. And then it builds this association with training and pain. When they can't wrap their head around how I go out for ride the bike for 5-6 hours, I'm like, because all I'm doing is looking over the hedges and listening to music. It's not that stressful.
You know, they think that you have to sweat. You have to throw up at the end of an intense session. And that if you're not somehow miserable and exhausted by the time you get back to the trailhead, you didn't do anything right, or you didn't do anything helpful. So a lot of these people, I throw my book at them and I ask them to read a few chapters. I have a lot written on my website about this. And especially if their goal is to live longer, right? Not of all of us, you know, could be a Cat 1 cyclist. We're just out here to live longer and, you know, and healthier and thrive. And so if that's their motivation, then I can sort of build a science behind why easy training works. Why go take a 3-mile walk with your dog? That works. If you want, throw some sandbags into a knapsack and add 10 or 20 pounds to yourself.
Well, you know what I've noticed since I've started walking? Most people that are running should be walking. You yes. see most people around the local park and the beach and they're running towards me and they're 50 pounds overweight. They're easily zone 5 and they right. are just hammering themselves. And they're getting through, if you think about how many kilojoules they're getting through in a workout, because they're getting maybe 4 or 5 kilometers of this sort of intensity. They're coming right. home and I can picture the scene already, like the wife or the girlfriend's making the meals for the rest of the night. She's walking the dogs. They're dead. And then the next day, the delayed onset muscle soreness and the right. day after and the day after. So you end up getting, I don't know, 600 kilojoules spread over 3-4 days before they have the motivation to go again. Whereas you could get out walking and, you know, you're going to have no soreness the next day.
And the benefits of walking are pretty extraordinary. I mean, you can watch, you know, on HIV for training or, you know, my Polar Watch or anything else, you'll see your fitness jump as you walk or ruck yourself to fitness. I had COVID in October 22. And hit me like a ton of bricks. So I had long COVID. I couldn't do anything. I couldn't even walk stairs for a month without being short of breath. I was brain dead, had to be on a couch, asleep by 2 o'clock. And gradually after about 6 weeks, I started walking. I couldn't even think of running. You know, to keep my heart rate under 130, I had to walk slowly. It was just atrocious. But I learned the power of walking just from doing that. And I walked myself back to my level of fitness. It took a long time, but I did it. It's an incredibly effective way to train aerobically, period, end of it. It's really important for people to realize you don't have to sweat and kill yourself on a bike or on a run. And it's funny. I'll schedule some meetings for the early morning when I'm in my run. And sometimes the people on the call are like, where are you? I'm like, I'm running. They're like, you're not running. I said, yeah, I am running. Like, you could talk and run. I said, yeah, you can. If you train yourself correctly, you will.
How do you think about shoe choice for someone starting to walk? I know there's a lot of recent talk about the weight of the toe box and, you know, building toe strength as part of walking, and Vibram and other shoes like this, or Zeros, I think, are the other brand I'm seeing a lot of people recommending. Are you fussy on shoe choice? Do you think it matters?
So most toe problems, toe deformities, bunions, hammer toes, etc., are a problem of shoe wearing populations. You know, we cram our feet into shoes, and they're not supposed to work like that. An interesting experiment: you take your fist, it closes easily. Now squeeze that like your shoes do. You can't make a fist. So the same thing is happening to our toes when we thrust them into certain shoes. So I am a big fan of more of the anatomical fits with a wider toe box. Whether you want to go to zero drop, non-zero drops, I don't care. And it really doesn't matter, especially if you're just starting out. Listen, these are one of those things you can't overly complicate. You're going to do just fine in the shoe that fits you well. So we have a great running store in our area. They'll let you go run out on the street or run on a treadmill for half an hour if you're buying a new pair of shoes. And so you come back and say yes or no. But don't let anyone talk you into a shoe because you overpronate, you oversupinate, you need a zero drop. You may cause more problems than you're going to avoid. And besides, you know, we're not winning any races. You don't need any carbon fiber in those shoes. They're causing stress fractures in people who wear them too often. Zero drops, you know, if you haven't run and you start wearing zero drops, your Achilles is going to hit you in the ass really soon. And if you develop Achilles tendinopathy, that's going to be with you for a year. You know, you're going to have this little grape-sized growth in your Achilles tendon, and you're just going to be miserable. So I prefer not too concentrated on that. I've run in Ghosts and Ultras my whole life, my whole adult running life, and I just haven't changed because I have no need to change.
Simplicity, consistency.
They're comfortable, they work, and I know when to change them. You know, I like having two shoes because, you know, the foot strike pattern is a little different. And so it changes the stress that my feet are seeing. But that's as complicated as I get.
Howard, thank you very much for your time.
My pleasure, Anthony.
If you enjoyed this video and you want to keep binge watching the content, check this video. It's a cracker. Also, don't forget to subscribe to the channel. That way, I can catch you in the next one. See you then.